Global Capital Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Global Capital Podcast. I'm Ralph Sinclair and I'm the Frequent Issuer's Managing Editor.
And I'm John Hay, Corporate Finance and Sustainability Editor, with a cough.
And I'm Mike Turner, Corporate Bonds Reporter.
Marvellous. Now, each week we bring you nourishment from around the capital markets. And on today's show, we'll be talking about a revival in Latin America's bond market and making an assessment of the EU's desire to be seen as a sovereign issuer, as it revealed a much more supranational level of funding that it needs to do for the second half of the year. But first, we're going to be talking about Thames Water, like most of the UK seems to be this week. It's been a huge story, not just for the capital markets. Now, we're going to get into the very interesting story that Mike's written about that this week, which you contributed to, John, along with our European CLO reporter, Victoria Teeler, about the way Thames's debts are structured. But first, just to set the scene, Thames Water is the UK's biggest water utility. It supplies around 19 million people in and around London. That's over a quarter of the country's population. It was privatised in 1989 under Margaret Thatcher. And this week, its CEO stepped down with immediate effect. And there's talk it might be renationalised or put into a special administrative regime. In short, it's up the spout. Now, John, first of all, what's been causing the company all these problems?
Well, it's rather strange because they've all just sort of suddenly blown up this week and in headlines. And it really has been a sort of media storm around the company. I mean, there's no immediate problem, right? It's not about to run out of money or anything like that, as far as we can tell. But the government and Ofwat, the regulator, have been having contingency plan talks just to make sure they're ready if something goes wrong. I think the fundamental reason, well, there are two problems. One is their cost of interest has gone up because a lot of their debt is inflation linked and inflation is high. So that means they have to pay more on their bonds. That should be compensated by increases in their revenues, but there are mismatches. But I think the more fundamental problem is that, Thames Water's operational performance just has been poor, and they've got a lot of money that they're going to need to invest in the network. This is demanded by the regulator, and it looks like they are going to need more equity from their shareholders, and that's the rub. That the equity shareholders are not immediately rushing forward to offer the money.
Yeah, they might not run out of money, but I suspect there's some fear they might run out of water, given the amount they seem to leak through their pipes. Mike, what's the reaction been in the bond market to all of this?
It's been mixed, I think it would be fair to say. So the nature of Thames Water is that a large part of it is of its debt is secured, which makes it much safer than unsecured debt, obviously. But the way that it works is through a whole business securitization, where there are three companies within Thames Water. Now, this is a very complicated structure for a company that's been likened to almost like high yield. And I spoke to an expert on it, Dr. Kate Bayliss, who is an infrastructure expert. And she said, she used the phrase impossibly complicated. And she has a PhD in infrastructure financing. So, if she can't look at it and work it out, and that implies it is pretty complicated.
Yeah.
But there are three companies: Thames Water Utilities Holding, Thames Water Utilities, and Thames Water Utilities Finance, and they are ring fenced within securitization, secured financing, and what that means is that their bonds are actually doing okay. They had slight sell offs, but all of their bonds are secured against assets. Hmm. Outside of that, there is another company called Kemble Water Finance Limited, and that also issues bonds, and it's a holding company for Thames Water. Their bonds have been absolutely obliterated. The cash price has collapsed almost as soon as the headlines hit screens.
Now, this whole business securitization, the Thames Water bonds, you say, are ring-fenced. That's secured debt. Presumably, they're secured on the operational revenues of Thames Water. Is that right? And that's why they're a safer investment, I guess, than the Holdco Kemble bonds. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, the revenue and the assets.
Right.
And that's the idea of a whole business securitization. It was invented in the 1990s. As a sort of really what felt like a massive technological innovation at the time. Until then, securitizations had always been, you know, conventional financial assets, loans of one kind or another. Basically, you sold into a vehicle and they were then owned by that vehicle and their cash flow therefore serviced the bonds. But with a whole business securitization, they invented a way to have the benefits of secured funding over a whole business, all its cash flows, all its assets and so on. And that is, you know, enabled essentially a higher levels of debt to be put on the company for equivalent ratings.
So is this an example of securitization saving the day rather than causing a crisis, as it is so often blamed for doing?
It is hard to tell yet, because we're not through this by any means. Thames Water put out a statement yesterday saying that they had plenty of liquidity and they're sort of in talks with their shareholders for more money. But it seems that less so saving the day. I think it's more just highlights the importance of capital structure when it comes to crises like this. The Thames Water, the three Thames Water companies that I named that are within the sort of securitization ring fence, it would take the whole company collapsing entirely for bondholders there not to be paid out.
Presumably for no one to need water.
Exactly.
Like complete catastrophic. Something that it won't happen because people will be fighting in the streets we'll be in the post-apocalypse. But it's certainly held up, and it's a test of whole business securitization that it seems to be passing.
Yeah, and I think these whole business securitizations in the water sector, where it's been quite a popular technique, they have a sort of further level of backing from the regulatory structure of the industry. Because it's such a highly regulated industry, they're actually monopolies as well, unlike some other utilities. Everybody knows that the regulator is not going to let the company go down. They need to ensure water supply, and they need to ensure that the company remains viable. And in the regulator's view, that includes being able to continue issuing investment grade debt. And therefore, you know, the regulator will ensure that the regulated assets remain investment grade. And that's basically, it's not a credit guarantee from the government, but it's a pretty strong support that people can rely on.
And you can see that the bond investors believe that as well, because their bonds sold off by, 2 or 3 points, which on such big news is kind of within the margin for error.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, give us the contrast. By how much did the Kemble bonds fall?
Yeah, so the holding company bonds fell by 29 points. So from the mid-80s to the mid-50s, which means that bonds that are notionally worth £1 are now worth 55p if you're trying to sell them. And that is real, like, distressed levels of trading.
Okay, well, that's Thames Water. But what about the water sector in the UK more widely? Is it in a healthy shape or not?
UK government has repeatedly said that it's financially resilient as a sector, as have Ofwat. And then there are sort of disparate pieces of news. Yorkshire Water, which is one of the companies that Ofwat said needs to be tested further for financial resilience. Basically, they put a bit of a red flag over the company, along with Thames Water was also in that group. And this happened in 2022. Yorkshire Water, independent of Thames Water, it just happens to have all come out in the same week, got a £500 million cash injection from its shareholders. So just to really stress this, this happens before anything happened at Thames Water. It's not like there was a big panic and then shareholders threw money at Yorkshire Water. Raising £500 million from shareholders is not the full amount of money that Yorkshire Water will need for all the upgrades needed. I think the Thames Water upgrade suggestion is something like 1.5 billion, just to give a ballpark area. But it does hint that the rest of the sector has got financial backing and has got access to finance, which is always a good sign.
I think what this shows is, assuming we're right and things continue the way they have so far, it shows that whole business securitization works for the at least in these cases, for the purposes it was set out to do, right? And there have been a lot of other tests of it over the years, including the pub sector and, you know, motorway service areas and so on. I'm not going into, you know, whether it passed the test in those cases, but in this regulated industry, you know, it's holding up. But what I think is more likely to show cracks is the whole financing model that included it. And that includes the water companies being owned by essentially a lot of pension funds and sovereign wealth funds. The companies tend not to be listed anymore. Thames Water was delisted a long time ago. And so they're privately owned by largely offshore shareholders, although, you know, it does have as a large shareholder the university's superannuation scheme, which is, the biggest pension fund in the UK. But the question of whether this type of investor can be responsive enough and sort of ready enough to put in capital when needed is what's at stake here, I think. And you know, if it proves that they're not, then, you know, this ownership model will be under strain.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, I Thames Water's sort of suffering through the era of inflation and rising rates is one thing, but, you know, it has this problem because it has so much fundamental investment to make in its infrastructure. And I think this does raise questions about whether private owners, therefore profit-taking, are really appropriate owners of what are sort of natural monopolies. And not to put the whole system on trial, but there has to be a consideration, I think, for, you know, railways, utility companies and all sorts. I mean, do you agree with that, or should we avoid the communist revolution at this stage?
Well, there are arguments either way, right? There's the argument that the private sector is sort of naturally better positioned to run companies because they are much more a part of the cut and thrust of competition and capitalism and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So they can see where efficiencies should be made rather than a big bulging, bloated public sector. But, you know, in this instance, clearly the private sector hasn't made the investments they need to in the water industry. There's, you know, huge wastage, and for weeks now, there's been reporting about sewage dumping into the sea around the UK, and it all falls into the same bracket of lack of investment in infrastructure. So, you know, can the lot in government now do a better job than those who privatized it in the first place? You know, who knows, but it definitely needs a shake up. But maybe having that threat and pressure of nationalization will force private sector owners to, you know, be more active and be more responsive. Fingers crossed, you know, that's the hope.
Well, I think when they were first privatized, weren't they? Part of the argument for that was that they would be more efficiently run or better run. I think you can probably confidently argue they haven't necessarily been. The other point was to engender some sort of public ownership through the equity market, mass public ownership of national assets. And I guess that really has failed because a lot of these companies that were privatized and sold, well, the shares have all ended up, or the ownership has all ended up with these behemoth pension funds and sovereign wealth funds.
Well, don't forget that pension funds are the savings of all of us. And, you know, okay, it's a fairly not granular investor register at Thames Water. And, you know, a lot of them are not UK. But nevertheless, you know, there are still UK shareholders effectively through the university pension scheme.
So how good do we think the government is at running companies like this?
Well, I wouldn't assume that the government would be any better. You know, the history of state-owned enterprises is not glittering, and that, you know, they can suffer from underinvestment too. They always have to compete in the political arena for resources. And, you know, one of the reasons for privatization was that, you know, that wouldn't have to happen anymore. You wouldn't have to have water fighting with health and, you know, and so on. So it was meant to be a sort of more stable and sort of independent way of financing industries like that. But I think it is worth mentioning Railtrack, which is an example in the UK of a company that was privatized and then being taken back into state ownership because it just didn't work out. And the Railtrack, which is now Network Rail, has remained in state hands. There's still a lot of complaints about it, but it hasn't been a disaster.
No. Going on to the background of all of this, this sort of rather acute news item this week, has been a more long-running theme for us at Global Capital anyway, of how the European Union wants to be seen in the bond market. And that Georgie Lee, our SSA reporter, got a chance to examine that this week when the EU announced its borrowing programme for the second half of the year.
So the EU's a major borrower. What were they planning to borrow?
Yes, major indeed. So it wasn't until a couple of years ago. And then as a result of the pandemic support that the EU is providing to member states, it's ballooned into an absolute bond market behemoth. It's the biggest supranational agency by quite some margin. It borrows 120 billion euros a year, that's last year and this year. That also makes it a bigger issuer than 23 of its member states. The next biggest superagency issuer is probably KfW, which I think borrows between 80 and 90 billion a year. So it's bigger by quite some whack. Because it borrows so much, all the other issuers have to sort of dance around it and arrange their borrowing around what the EU is going to do. Because of the EU's issuance process, it has set dates when it brings bond syndications and auctions, and it sends out requests for proposals in advance of that. So the SSA bond market spends a long time thinking about and preparing for what the EU is going to do. So it really has changed the behavior of borrowers in that market entirely. So that's why people were so curious, I guess, or so, it was so important to see what the EU was going to borrow for the second half of the year. Now, it did 80 billion euros in the first half, and people were expecting, you know, by and large, something like maybe 50 to 60 billion euros. Some people expected more. But actually, the EU is going to be borrowing far less. It's only going to be looking for a mere 40 billion euros in the second half of the year.
So what does this mean for the markets then, if they're borrowing so much less?
Well, it's probably a great thing if you're a public sector funding official, because you've got far less to worry about in terms of the EU taking demand out of the market. You know, the proof of that was in how bonds traded once the EU had made its announcement. The long end of the curve, which is where the EU does most of its issuance because it has an average duration for its programme of 15 years, those bonds tightened by about 8 basis points. And in the middle of the curve, where a lot more of the SSAs do their funding, prices moved in, or sorry, spreads moved in by 2 to 3 basis points.
So why is the EU borrowing less than people expected? I mean, after all, it's a very sort of carefully studied issue. How come the market got it wrong?
Yeah, well, it's not just that the EU is this sort of curious mix between a sovereign and a supranational. It also operates in a sort of different way to the others with regards to what it disperses. Now, key to this is the Next Gen EU programme, which is an 800 billion euro programme to, as I said, support member states on their way out of the COVID pandemic. Now, part of this is the rather snappily named Repower EU programme, which is 300 billion euros aimed at increasing the EU's energy diversity, security and efficiency. In a nutshell, it takes time for member states to work out what they want to borrow or what grants they want from the EU and to apply. Because obviously there are sort of political ramifications to all of this as well. And the time that is taking for them to sort of submit their requests mean the EU doesn't need to borrow as much this time round. So it's quite possible, you might think, that come next year, the EU will have more to do in the bond market as more requests for funding come in.
So is this a dent to the EU's sort of pretensions to be seen as a sovereign style issuer, with which, after all, the attributes include large issuance and great regularity of issuance?
Yeah, well, I mean, the EU can certainly still claim that it does an awful lot of issuance and it does it regularly. It does it through syndications and auctions, and it issues bills too. Now, it has 300 billion euros of bonds outstanding. All of these are sort of tick boxes in its kind of sovereign credentials file. But of course, you're right, John. What people sort of worry about, and this is not a new thing, is how long is the EU going to be borrowing this volume of debt for? Because all of these programs that it's running, both the support for Ukraine, the Next Gen EU program, and so on, they're all designed to be temporary. And what people want from a government borrower and what they get from a government is consistency of issuance. And certainly, if you're going to plunge your second half borrowing requirement in such a way, it does rather sort of add grist to the mill of those who think you should stay in your supranational box.
It kind of chimes well, though, with what the EU is. It fits across lots of different boxes and does lots of different things in a very different way to how sovereigns do and any agency does. So it almost feels like the EU should have its own box within how investors look at things.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair. It's not a pure supranational because it is, of course, a sovereign entity in and of itself. However, it's not quite like a proper sovereign because it's just not that simple an institution. So it does have this sort of, you know, hybrid quality to it. It's also, you know, there is sort of, I guess, for Europhiles who love more Europe, then it's got a strategic value to being seen as a sovereign issuer. There's also a pricing benefit to be had, more to the point, because if it trades closer and closer to its member states' bonds, then, you know, it pays less to borrow the money, which it then disperses back out to them.
That's a curious thing, though, with that, because that is obviously true. But also this schedule that the EU has with its issuance means that it is, to some degree, a sort of pricing insensitive, you know, because otherwise it would wait for a good window and then bring its deal rather than telling people when it's going to come. So it's a bit of a dichotomy there in the way that the EU views its pricing.
Well, I think how this works is it wants to be seen as this sovereign or sovereign type issuer. To sort of, I guess, drive demand for its issuance because it's becoming at all times. So it still has a duty to try and make itself the, you know, best, get itself the best value funding. And it gets to play this kind of handy sort of circumstance where if it can portray itself as a sovereign, but a sovereign that still trades, I don't know, say 20 basis points back of France, then that looks to investors like something that's great value.
So are there any other signs, Ralph, that bear on this question at the moment?
Yeah, well, there's something that we've mentioned before, but that took effect this week, which is that the European Central Bank has moved the EU's bonds into its Category 1 for repo collateral treatment. I won't bore you with the full details of that, but what it means is it now treats EU bonds like any other government bond, which makes them more attractive collateral, and that again sort of burnishes its sovereign style credentials. The other thing is something the EU told us about, which was the turnover versus the volume of its bonds, which is a measure of how liquid you are. Obviously, government bond markets are supposed to be the most liquid of all. Now, European government bonds, that ratio of turnover to volume is something like 48% on average. In the first quarter of this year, the EU went from a ratio of 50% up to 67%. So definite signs that the EU is certainly big enough and liquid enough at the moment to back up its claims.
So moving out of Europe to Latin America, there has been an absolute explosion of issuance there after a really abysmal first half of the year. Could you perhaps talk us through what's happened there?
Well, I think first of all, our thoughts and prayers to our US Bureau Chief and Latin America correspondent, Ollie West, who for months has been sat in New York in the right time zone, struggling to find things to write about, urging all the issuers to come to the market. And now he's in London working unsociable hours. They've all decided to show up in the market at once, haven't they, John?
Yeah, well, it really has been remarkable. The Latin American bond bankers are... They've seen a few rodeos, right, in that market, and the LATAM bond issuers are notorious for delaying, right, and sort of always wanting to wait and get the best price, not coming to market when, you know, out of caution and sort of prudence. And but even they are surprised by the behavior this year. The market was wide open in January. Pretty much all other sectors of the bond market, apart from emerging markets, but even, you know, some emerging market issuers in the European time zone came to the market in large volume, right? And LATAM just sat it out completely. And, you know, they waited and waited. There was basically nothing's happened through all the ups and downs of this spring. And, you know, it was getting to a sort of bizarre level of sort of inaction. But that finally has broken in the last couple of weeks, and particularly this week with a slew of deals.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen some of the most storied names in the Latin America bond market, haven't we? We've seen Petrobras being a $1.25 billion dollar 10-year. Chile bought a sustainability-linked bond. It raised $2.25 billion. America Movil, which is probably the absolute darling of the LATAM corporate bond market, and I think probably fair to say plenty don't even see it as a sort of Latin America credit almost, do they? They almost treat it as like a sort of US high grade issuer. And then there was Paraguay, Ecopetrol, and then of course last week we had CNPC and BBVA Mexico. One of the things that Ollie's told us about down the years is that there's a real sort of pack mentality to the issuers in this market. And when they come to market, they sort of, like, they don't, no one wants to be seen as the one to go first and do a deal that might not work. So it's perhaps not surprising that we've seen so many arrive in the market all at one time. But what do you think were the drivers behind them all arriving now?
I think the fundamental thing is confidence on the US economy and interest rates. I mean, the US economy's been remarkably resilient. Although there were, you know, a lot of economists predicted with certainty that there would be a recession, it hasn't happened yet. You know, there's a good number who believe it might escape it altogether. You've had interest rates going up and up and up, and they're finally slowed down. And, the Fed seems to be winning the battle with inflation. This is the big thing for Latin American bonds. And if the market has now sort of genuinely reached a turning point where people can start to think about the next direction of rates being down, then, you know, the Latin American borrowers probably sense that now's the time to come to the market. However, it's not that they've necessarily chosen the best moment. You know, bankers that advise them and that are now doing these deals for them are still kind of shaking their heads, really, and saying, you know, for example, one issuer cost itself 200 basis points by not coming when the banks first started to encourage it to do so at the beginning of last year.
There's also in Ollie's story this week, there's also a quote from a banker saying that the sudden return of activity is frankly bizarre. And that's from a syndicate banker who worked on multiple deals. And he thinks it's just a case of issuers getting the itch to come and issue. And that, I think there's also, you know, quite a lot of credence to that view that they've held off for so long now that one has done it and it's gone okay. It's just a case of just piling in, because not only do you not want to, you don't want to be the first one to do it and not get it wrong, but you also don't want to miss out when everyone else is doing getting it right.
Yeah. And how are the deals going?
In the secondary market, they are all pretty stale. No real performance, which people in that market are taking to show that it's, you know, despite this lots of glitter and glamour in the primary market, it's actually not a particularly healthy market.
It's maybe that's a result of this sort of binging approach the issuers are taking. And we a lot of in corporate bonds about investor indigestion.
But then at the same time, you'd think that if you're a Latin American fund manager and you're looking to buy, you know, Latin American debt, if there hasn't been anything all year, then you've got a lot of money that you've been desperate to put to use. So you would think that, you know, we're nearly in July now. So they have got lots, you know, they've got half a year's worth of money that they need to spend. So you'd think that there'd be better performance on that basis.
I suppose another factor could be that if investors can sense that the bout of issuance is now beginning, and it's certainly the case that a lot of the deals have had very good execution in the primary market, like, you know, paying next to no new issue premium in some cases. It could be that the investors are fighting to get into the new deals, but they're not going to waste money on buying in the secondary market, you know, to follow on. if there are more new deals coming. So it might be that.
We've also seen something similar in the financial institutions bond market in Europe last couple of weeks, where it seemed for months like every deal was working, banking crisis notwithstanding, that sort of short period of time. But it's got to the stage where, and I think also we see this in the SSA market to an extent somewhat, especially with the EU's program. You know, if people know or people believe that there's going to be another deal along in a minute that might pay a bit more, well, why pile in this week and compete for that issuance? It's the fundamentals and the rates backdrop is of course one part of the picture, but the sort of technical supply and demand dynamics in the market are quite another. And I think if I was a LATAM fund manager and I suddenly thought, well, you know, there'll be plenty more along next week as well, then I might also hold off, and certainly, like you say, John, not try and fill up whatever I was under allocated on in the secondary market.
I suppose that the next thing will be whether the market opens up to sort of lower tier issuers, basically. And, you know, Ollie's, one of the things been writing about this year is a real distress for a lot of the sort of mid-tier Latin American companies, you know, big enough companies to have issued international bonds, but nevertheless facing, you know, debt distress. And, you know, so it's not an untroubled sector, and whether, you know, these sort of less blue chippy names can follow the ones that have come so far is I think will be the story of the next couple of weeks.
To follow all the stories discussed on this week's podcast and much more besides, please go to globalcapital.com. Meanwhile, thank you to John and Mike for joining me to record this edition of the podcast. And thank you most of all for listening. We'll be back with more from the capital markets next week. Thank you and goodbye.